Hello and welcome to this very special edition of Downstream IRL, very kindly hosted by Reference Point. If you're watching this on YouTube, you've got no idea that 100 people have dragged their carcasses early in the morning to be with us today, and that's for a very special reason. I'm delighted to say that we are joined by Judith Butler, philosopher. Philosopher, author, and as I found out this morning, fan of hard-boiled eggs. They need no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. They are the author of seminal works such as Gender Trouble, Bodies That Matter, Frames of War, and their new book, Who's Afraid of Gender, which examines how a transphobic backlash morphed into an all-out war against so-called gender ideology. It takes us from the Vatican to the conservative right, and it best of all dissects how Britain became Turf Island. I'm so sorry that you have to be with us today, but
I'm glad to be here. Glad to be here. Very honored, actually.
So I guess my first question is, when someone pops up and says, "What is a woman?"
Yeah.
What are they really asking?
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, it depends who's asking and to whom the question is addressed. But if Rishi Sunak asks that question of the Labour Party more generally, or its current representative, he's trying to ridicule them or catch them out because you look kind of foolish if you don't know, or you say, "Well, I'm not sure," or actually the category is open. It's like, oh, come on. It's common sense. Everybody knows you're like in some airy, obscurantist, woke ether, and you're having a problem with a very commonsensical question, right? So the person who asks it in that way is trying to ally with common sense or with the common people who share a common sense. But the so-called common people who share a common sense also might have a trans kid or a cousin or have a gender nonconforming uncle. Right? Didn't we all have a gender nonconforming uncle?
I'm going to ask him.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a way of reconsolidating this idea of common sense, of natural difference, and debunking those who open up the question as either detached intellectuals out of touch with common sense, or with some kind of wokeism understood as a set of principles that are being imposed on common sense reality from a doctrinaire position.
Is there a way to answer that question in good faith, in a way which is inclusive and acknowledges the variety of the human species, but also is able to grapple with the fact that when someone says woman, it does mean something to most people?
Well, I think if we were even to try to answer the question, we would need a multilingual framework, right?
What's that?
Well, how are women referred to or understood in various languages, in various ways of speaking? How are women thought about in history? How has the idea of what a woman is changed in different histories, in different parts of the globe? So we would need a global framework. We would need a multilingual framework looking at different ways that women are defined. We would then need to understand why it was always so important to feminism to keep the question open. Why would feminists do that? Well, because they didn't like received ideas of what a woman is or is supposed to be, right? She stays at home, involved in reproductive labor alone, supposed to be sentimental, not supposed to be rational, not capable of certain kinds of labor, uniquely capable for other kinds of labor. We opened the question, what is a woman? We even opened the question, what does a woman want in psychoanalysis, we opened those questions because we were not happy with the ways in which those definitions were operating. And people did, of course, have some pretty intense ways of thinking about this. So if you live in a society in which women aren't supposed to do certain labor or aren't supposed to look a certain way, are you still a woman if you do that labor or you look a certain way? Right? We, as feminists, I thought, were saying, yeah, you are. Of course you are. You want to be a woman? Come on in. Of course you are. Let's expand that category. Let's make it more inclusive. So it's been important to an emancipatory project to keep the question of what a woman is open. So why would we, at a certain point in our illustrious history as feminists, ever decide, no, we're closing the door, you know, we're not going to extend the category, you can't claim it. Well, why not? We've been expanding that category, accepting its internal diversification for a really long time. We've gone on the streets for that purpose. Why would we suddenly decide, oh, this is the limit case?
I mean, you're referring a lot to feminism there, and I suppose that leads me onto the question of why is it that in the UK, transphobia has come in the guise of feminism, so-called gender-critical feminism, as opposed to the much more explicitly right-wing, family-oriented, religiously inflected iterations of other countries?
That's such a good question. Well, first of all, let me just say, I think we need to reclaim feminism, trans feminism, intersectional feminism, post and decolonial feminism. There are all kinds of feminisms out there that are really important, abolitionist, black feminism. We do not give feminism away. We do not. We reclaim it, okay? We make sure that we know how to keep it open, keep it thoughtful, keep it self-critical, When we talk about critical, gender critical, I never understand what's being said. because critical, what does it mean? If you're a feminist and you're critical, that means you call into question the presuppositions that you have received unthinkingly. It's like you become more thoughtful. You ask, well, why have I proceeded with that category in that way? You allow yourself to be changed by the history of emancipatory movements to rethink the fundamental categories, and you have humility, and you change, and you become more inclusive, and more, you offer more recognition, and you accept that the categories that we often consider to be so fundamental are historically changing, and it's a good thing, because we want to be part of that historical change. I think that I can't give you the so-called diagnosis of UK turfism. I think
we're undiagnosable as a country, and I take great pride in that.
But you know, I do think it's against the background of a shattered left that these kinds of intensely sectarian fights start happening. The only way to have a political position is to identify, perhaps as a woman or perhaps as a lesbian, and to guard that territory and to make it into a kind of vault or a gated community that controls who can enter and who belongs. And I think that kind of territoriality happens when people are very unsure about their alliances or where they belong and what their broader political aims are, right? So I don't exactly know how to account for it, but I do think that there are great fears that I hear trans-exclusionary feminists speaking about. They're afraid of being replaced. They're afraid of being violated. They're afraid of having the definition of womanhood appropriated. And I think it's worth thinking about, well, what are the conditions under which those become primary fears? And what are the ways of addressing that fear without seeking recourse to an exclusionary politics? It would be great if that could be opened as a debate as a really serious question. I think we should take other people's fears seriously, especially when they turn quickly to either to hatred or to discriminatory or exclusionary politics. But maybe there's a way to go back to the fear and say, well, let's talk about that first and see whether another path is possible.
I mean, I'm using the word transphobia quite broadly. And of course, a lot of the time what we're talking about is the demonization of trans women in particular.
Yes.
Right? We're not talking about the demonization of trans men, though, of course, that does happen.
Well, trans men are called self-hating lesbians or, you know, whatever happened to the butch. The butch is being effaced from the earth, and the trans,
How are the butches getting along? Still there? Still all right? I mean,
well,
but
you can affirm a history as a butch and be a trans man. And Jack Halberstam has taught us a little bit about how trans asterisk works in that way to be a more inclusive category.
But why is it trans women in particular? Because when I try and sort of extract what the big story is from a lot of the things that I'm reading, whether it's in the Times, the Guardian, it's sort of this idea of, you know, here's someone who's assigned male at birth and they've got this power and they can only be using it for ill. They're becoming like a wolf in sheep's clothing or something
yes,
like that.
Yes.
Like, is that a genuine fear or is it a convenient way of appropriating the position of the victim when wanting to oppress others?
You know, I think I think the fear does rest on a misunderstanding or perhaps a willful ignorance about what trans masculinity is and how it operates, and or what trans femininity is and how it operates. And I think we need to go back to some fundamentals here. If you're assigned male at birth, that doesn't immediately give you power. It's once you enter into the social world that you see what that assignment can mean. A lot of people assigned male at birth are really unhappy with that assignment, and it doesn't serve them. And in fact, they suffer under it. And they may well not like the expectations of sexuality or the expectations of gender that go along with that assignment and contest it. And those folks have to go through some real social challenges to secure the sex assignment that they do want and need to live in the way that they want. So that history of suffering, of aspiration, of desire, that deep sense of self that needs and ought to have social recognition is not properly honored by those who would reduce somebody to their sex assignment or even the fact that they may well have a penis. Having a penis does not immediately give you social power, especially if you don't want it. It's just kind of complicated, you know, or you want it out of play or some other things are more erotic for you. Like, we don't even have that discussion openly. It's just assumed like, oh, you're assigned male, you have a penis, therefore you are a potential rapist. Is that the way we feel about our sons? No. Our fathers, our friends, our lovers? No. We know that men negotiate social violence in different ways, that a lot of men can be ethical, and that masculinity is in the process of being reproduced in some interesting ways by trans men, by younger men who've been, you know, brought up by feminist parents or who've entered culture and learned a lot about what it is ethically to be a man, how to comport yourself ethically as a man in this world. We want that. We hope for that. We support that. So, like I was saying about the category of woman, the category of man is also historical. And we need to be interested in the social reproduction of masculinity and make sure it's being reproduced in some good ways.
So, not that the devil needs an advocate, but someone like J.K. Rowling or Julie Bindle, they would say that they're speaking up for the most disadvantaged women in society. So women in prison, survivors of domestic violence. And sure, debating who goes in what prison might be an edge case, but it certainly does matter if you're a woman in that prison. So what would you say to those people who would say that actually they're coming at it from a perspective of risk management?
Yes. I wonder whether we could easily in the UK, in the US and elsewhere, find statistics that support the notion that prison guards are actually more dangerous to women in prison. I mean, by whom are women in prison violated? Sometimes by other women, sometimes by prison guards, both men and women. I think the way gender operates, the way power operates in prison, the way sexual violation operates is a larger picture. I'd like to see the larger picture first, and then we can ask that question about this trans woman who happens to be in a women's prison rather than a men's, because what's going to happen to that trans woman in a men's prison? That trans woman is going to be the object of sexual violation. So if you say that person should, out of concern for the sexual violation of women, and we'll just leave that open category, that a trans woman should be in a men's prison, what you're doing is recommending sexual violation over there in order to protect yourself against the prospect, the fantasy of a sexual violation over here. Maybe we need the broader picture of how is sexual violation actually happening in prisons, and then we can make a more grounded judgment.
I mean, what we know is that trans women in prisons in England or Wales are much more likely to be victims of sexual violation than perpetrators of sexual violation. And that, yeah, the broader picture of statistics bears that out. But someone might say, okay, drawing back to that bigger picture isn't telling me what to do with this immediate situation as and when it arises. You know, there's a question of rights here and how you balance them. And I suppose I'm interested in, do you buy that there are conflicts of rights here, or are there ways to sort of integrate them?
I think the question for anybody who is at risk of being sexually violated in prison is, what is the recourse within prison to protect oneself against it? So the group that we would want women to be protected against are all those who might violate them. So the same procedure that would be used against a male guard or a woman guard or the exceptional trans woman would hold. We wouldn't single out a particular group, especially if statistically that group is not primarily responsible for sexual violation in prison. So it's not on the basis of identity or classification that we make that decision. We say anybody who violates another person sexually needs to be held accountable, and we need procedures for that. But we don't discriminate against kinds of violators. They're all bad. But look, there's an obvious point here that probably needs to be restated, and I always forget. You can find your example of a trans woman who did, in fact, threaten or violate another woman in prison. You can find your example. But if you make that example into then the general truth of the category, all trans women are this way, or all trans women represent this risk, then you are actually engaging in what's technically transphobia, right? Because we wouldn't say, oh, you know, I went into this store and I bought something from a Jewish store owner and I think I was overcharged. If somebody said to you, oh yeah, all the Jews do that, you would say, fuck you. That's like, excuse my language, sorry. You'd say that's anti-Semitism.
Don't worry, I've heard that before.
No, but seriously, or, you know, one black person does one thing. Well, that's what black people, and that's what happens in right-wing propaganda. right? That is exactly how presidential, you know, elections are run in the U.S. You find one migrant who did this one thing, and then that that stands for all migrants. So that's a right-wing strategy. It's a racist. It's a transphobic. It's an anti-Semitic strategy. We know how that works. You take the instance, you inflate it into the general category. So that needs to be stopped.
And before we move on from this discussion about gender-critical feminism, I'm going to do something really annoying and, like, quote your own partner back to you. But as I was reading your book, I was wondering about whether this narrative that you get from gender-critical feminists that trans and non-binary people are taking something from them.
Yeah, like, what are they taking?
You're taking language, taking attention, taking social capital or status from them. I wonder if that could be linked to Wendy Brown's idea of wounded attachment, that you have a wounded attachment to a position of marginality and there is a certain amount of social capital that comes with it and you don't want to let it go.
Well, if I understand Wendy Brown correctly,
this is the scariest moment of my life, by the way.
She's actually up the road. We could probably call her. We do suffer wounds, you know, many of us, gay, lesbian, trans, women, people of color, workers, a lot of us have been wounded, exploited, violated, right? We come with histories of wounds. There's no question about it. The question is, do we then stay attached to that wound and does that wound become the source of our identity and we just stay as a wounded identity in the political sphere and that's our operation to, you know, assert that wounded identity and stay attached to it? Or do we look around and say, well, who else got wounded and what did they do to overcome those wounds and what kind of alliances are necessary to make sure other people don't get wounded in this way and that we can affirm life not just from a wounded position, but from a place of what she's now calling reparation or a place indeed of emancipation or social struggle. So there are different trajectories that you can go through. But the question is, what is the wound to feminism? What's the wound to lesbianism, really, if the category of women is expanded to include trans women? What's the wound? How do any of the people who live in that category, how are they actually suffering? It seems to me that what they're suffering from is a kind of hatred or phobia that is overwhelming to them. And that's a corrosive set of emotions to live with. But I do understand that as, unfortunately, self-inflicted. I do think some of the debates here in the UK, especially online, where people are free to be as mean as they possibly can, some of the debates on all sides in the UK have been very disturbing to me. I don't think hideous insults and condemnations and accusations and vile ways of referring to other people are okay. I would rather see kind of meaningful open debate on these issues. So I don't think social media has helped this so-called conflict because it does escalate and foreground the cruelest and the meanest kinds of utterances. And maybe it's important to stay away from those. It's hard when you're fighting. You want to be cruel, you want to be snide, you want to ridicule people, you want to show that their position is preposterous. It's not going to persuade anybody. I think it might be better to figure out what are people really fearing and do they need to, and is there another way to talk about that?
I want to move the conversation on a little bit. You know, when somebody says, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm non-binary, it's not just about their right to perceive themselves in a certain way. It's also about the right to be perceived and affirmed and addressed in a certain way. And so I'm interested in the bit which is socially negotiated, right? So it's not just about what I say about myself. It's also about how other people, you know, address me, perceive me. Are there limits to the powers of self-definition?
Tell me what you have in mind.
So, for instance, if I was to continue presenting in the way that I am now, exactly the same, and I was to say, actually, my preference would be for he, him pronouns. I would like to be addressed as a man. there are lots of people who would say, I find this very challenging, what I'm seeing in front of me,
yeah,
and what you're asking me to do. There's a challenge here.
Yes.
So I've got the right to say, live with it. Mm-hmm. Live with the challenge.
Yeah. Well, I do think your question raises something kind of interesting. You know, the term gender. I mean, back in the day, you know, we would talk about the gender division of labor, and some socialist feminists still do, and it's important to do that, especially as we think about care work and social reproduction. And their gender is not about identity. It's actually about how society is organized according to this exceedingly important power differential. So gender is a framework, it's a structure. Then there's gender identity, and some people think, oh, gender is just gender identity, right? It's become synonymous with or shorthand for. And then once we go into the question of gender identity, we see that there's gender presentation, how we appear to ourselves perhaps or to others, and that can be very divergent. But that's divergent anyway, even among like so-called cis people. It's like, I think I look a certain way and you think I don't. And it's like, well, why? Well, because the way we perceive ourselves and the ways others perceive us can differ, and they can differ actually rather radically. So let's like hold that in mind, that there's no bridging of that gap once and for all in my mind. Even if you say I'm a woman and I say, yeah, I think you probably are, do we mean the same thing at that moment? Maybe not. You know, maybe I'm thinking one thing and you're thinking another. Okay. And there are different ways of being and presenting as a woman, right? And then it gets controversial. It's like, well, I don't think that presentation is... Okay, in any case, my point is simply that very often a felt sense of who one is and how one identifies is not always matched by a socially perceived gender presentation. And so if somebody tells you, this is actually how I understand myself, this is my lived reality, you do have a challenge, but you have a challenge because you are, if you're having trouble reconciling a certain gender presentation with that person's self-definition, you're assuming that gender presentation, that gender identification can be read off of gender presentation, and it is not always the case.
I understand that, and I understand that it's not always the case. But if I was talking to someone who is outside of this room, not super duper political, they'd say, it is quite often the case, though. And as a society, we live by rules of thumb. We can change those rules of thumb when we come across an exception, but I make judgments in a generalized way. That's how I get through my
day. We do, and it's actually one of the reasons why queer and gender nonconforming and trans kids have had such a hard time. Because, you know, they're going to school, they're looking the way they're supposed to look, more or less, or they're challenging that, and people are just saying, you're in this category, you're in this one, you know, we need to order society in a certain way, right? And what is the internal sense of suffering happens when you're like, put into a category that actually effaces who you are because you look a certain way to somebody who's imposing a set of social expectations on you, you know, at school, right, in religious institutions, on the street, in the family. It's like, but that's who you are, but that's how you look, but that's how I understand you. It's like, how to live with that deep sense of disjunction, and you're effaced by the very category by which you are generally recognized.
So it seems to me that a lot of the time when I'm talking to people who are very, very much involved with trans rights, there's sort of two ways of understanding it. There's one way where you sort of say, okay, what we're asking for isn't very much at all. It is the right to be affirmed in our chosen gender, and that is not an imposition on anyone else at all, right? You're changing how you know, speak, and it's coming from a respect for my humanity. And then there's another way of looking at it, which is saying, well, actually, people choosing to live in a gender which is not the one they were assigned at birth, and straining against these categories and challenging these categories and the connections between gender identification, gender presentation, and socially recognized gender, that is actually a really big deal. So I suppose my question is, how much of a big deal is it? Is it a small alteration of social norms, or is it actually something which is a lot more fundamental that's being posed here? That inherently we're talking about blowing up some of these categories of gender.
Mm. Well, if you're a biological essentialist, it's a revolution. If you are a member of a right-wing partisan of the Catholic Church and you believe in the natural family and creationism and that God created male and female, it's revolutionary. Okay, so for all those folks, it's really rough. And I'm sorry that they're having a hard time, but I think they need to go through it and come out the other end and join the rest of us in a better world. So it's okay, you know. I mean, I accept it's hard, sure. It's like deeply sentimented kind of beliefs and habits and ways of seeing. But it is true that a lot of people just want to be left alone and live without being pathologized and discriminated against or the object of violence or disdain. And that seems right, to be able to, NATO women, they want to walk down the street without being harassed. Like NATO women, they want to get a job without being discriminated against. They want to love who they want to love. They want their lives and their loves to be recognized minimally or maximally by society and to live in freedom and without fear. Seems pretty reasonable.
One of the things that you object to in the book is an idea of self-definition as being simply a form of radical liberty. The idea of, well, anyone can do anything now.
That's right.
So what is self-definition if not a form of radical liberty? And not simply a voluntarist decision of I'm this now.
I think it's really important to understand that there's a wide range of positions about gender identification, or what some would insist is sex identification. Identify as the sex, right? So I don't want to anymore at least make a distinction between sex as somehow natural and gender as somehow cultural and social. I think sex assignment is already political. It's already the act of social institutions. It's a way of organizing our bodies at the very beginning of time. So sex assignment is already the work of gender in my framework. You don't have to accept my framework. But I think for many people, the sex assignment they receive is deeply right and true and absolutely incontrovertible, and they would never change it, and they kind of like it, or they really like it, and they're living it out, and it's all good. Okay, but that's a relationship to a sex assignment. It happens to be a very harmonious one. It's like, yeah, I was called a girl, and now I'm a girl, and the girl is great, and I'm working with this category, and I love it. Okay, good. Go live. Enjoy.
I feel like you were channeling every member of the Spice Girls at once for that. Really were.
Well, but it's also kind of, it's always been amazing to me how people like do their girl thing. It's like, wow. You know, and I'm still kind of a child. I was a child ethnographer. It's like, whoa. Look at these people. They're like doing their gender in this way. It's like so amazing. It's like, wow. It's like a boy. It's like, boy. Boy, it's like doing this boy thing. It's like, wow. And I was like, you know, I was in this ethnographic, you know, interval, like, not sure can do either one very well. You know, so it's interesting. But then look, for some people, it's very fundamental. Like, this was never right. And for some, it's like, well, this was right for a while. Then it really wasn't right. Or this was okay for a while and then it was not right. Or I'm able to change this category and the expectations that it makes of me and still stay within it. And others are like, I can't stay within this category. It's unlivable to me. So I think what we're asking about is, what is the threshold of livability for people? And why wouldn't we respect that? If somebody says, this is not livable, and this is my chance for a livable life, why would we say, oh, no, no, sorry, you stay in the unlivable category and deprive you, and we will deprive you of a livable life? No, I think if we're not cruel people, we accept that somebody is telling us what's livable and what's unlivable. But do we call that a choice? It's like, well, it may be that the deepest sense of who one is as a sexed being or as a gender, if we're using that language, is not fully formed by us, right? We find ourselves feeling a certain way. We find ourselves understanding ourselves in a certain way. We come to grips with our sense of reality. And we're formed by many different social, familial, institutional powers, but we also form ourselves, or we come to understand ourselves. And it's at that point that we do make a choice, but it doesn't mean it's a choice from the very beginning.
I mean, thinking about, you know, something that you said in your book is that no one individual or class owns a gender category. So you can't say, well,
Beyonce does.
I'm so glad you said that. That was such an easy derailment. It really threw me, because I just wanted to be like, she's doing country music now, guys, and I really feel we need to discuss it.
She's taken over.
Oh, yeah. My God. So easy to distract me. So easy. But, like, you know, no one individual class owns gender categories apart from Beyoncé, the exception to every philosophical rule.
As long as we're clear,
We are very, very clear. Does the same apply to race? Because when I saw Rachel Dollaz out, I had this instinctive sense that there's something wrong here.
Yes.
But I don't own the category of race, right? No individual black person or class, right, socially constructed class of black people own the category of race. Rachel Dollaz out saying, well, look, I'm identifying as a black woman. I live my life as a black woman. My appearance is such that people are treating me as a black woman. Is it logically coherent to have different rules for gender as opposed to race? Was it coherent for me to feel very differently about Rachel Dollaz out than I intuitively think about gender identity?
Well, first of all, I agree with you that that what Rachel Donazal did and what people, white people, do who want to capitalize on cross-racial definition, identification, is completely objectionable. But they're not exactly parallel. As I was just saying, you know, gender is formed. It's very complicated. Race as a category, race as a classification, has a different history. And anybody who works in intersectional feminism would know that you don't tell the history of gender in the exact same way you tell the history of race. You actually look to see how these categories are intersecting in specific sites and through historical practices. But I don't think that they are parallel, because I don't even accept the idea that you just arbitrarily announce what your gender is. There's a formation process there. But racial identification is so intensely a matter of interpolation, like how you have been born into the world in and through a set of racial categories and formed as part of a community or part of a demographic classification, how you've been treated, how your self-understanding emerges. So we need to tell the specific history of that in order to understand why what Donazal did was so inappropriate and wrong. And she wasn't... I think when this question gets posed in this way, it assumes, like, oh, I'm just going to choose a new sex because I'm going to get some kind of publicity for this, like a fully voluntaristic notion. So I neither think of trans reassignment or self-definition as radically arbitrary, and nor do I think it is possible or right for that to happen, that for that particular kind of voluntaristic self-interested claim on blackness. I don't think that's ever justified. She didn't have that history. She didn't come into the world that way. She has not been interpolated. She has not lived through the history of that interpolation in the way that black people actually have. And that's a violation of that history. But when we're talking about the history of a trans person, well, they have been violated by categories, the wrong ones, and they're trying to emerge from violation. So let's think about where and how do we locate violation in both of those scenes.
I mean, to take it away from Rachel Dolezal, perhaps locate it in someone who is racialized in a way which marginalizes them. You talk about the threshold of livability. For lots of people of color, they'd say, well, this racial category is a violation of my humanity. How it's been made and how I'm made to live in it, the way society treats me, it is a violation. But the only thing there is to do is to sort of strain at what it might mean to be South Asian, to be Muslim, to be black, to be indigenous. And again, it's sort of saying, you know, is it okay to have just different rules for it? Like different rules, different pathways to go down when you are at that threshold of livability that is just different for race and for gender.
Well, it is, although, you know, it's very funny that we're involved in a discussion about analogy, because race and gender are lived together. Like, gender is never unmarked by race. Race is never unmarked by gender, and we know this. And yet, analytically, we set up this kind of hypothesis, which forces us into a kind of separation that's problematic. But just to stay with your example, I mean, isn't the lived historical reality that there are people who are like, don't racialize me, I'm just a human, treat me like a human. There are others is like, don't racialize me in this way. This is the way I am participating in and living out my racial affinity, identity, community. I may be straining against an interpolation that I feel like is falsifying or discriminatory, but I am also reproducing it in a way that I find to be affirmative, and actually making connections and coalitions among people of color or across even larger alliances. So we see that this is all lived out differently. I don't know if that answers your question, but I mean, that's the norm. That's the descriptive fact.
I mean, moving on a little bit, in the book, you distinguish between the demonization of so-called gender ideology and legitimate fears like forced migration, climate change, economic inequality, so on and so forth. An imaginary thoughtful right winger might say, well, look, actually, fearing the breakdown of social reproduction is a legitimate fear. You know, you look at what happens in countries which are richer, which have got, you know, more rights for women in terms of reproduction and the labor market, you get falling birth rates. And so without the sort of coercive stick of gender roles, you don't get babies. I mean, how would you respond to this?
Well, that is Victor, that is Viktor Orban's argument, right? But he's also really worried, not just that he won't get babies, but that they won't be reproducing the nation in its purity, which is why he's opposed to miscegenation. So I think we actually have to think about how the emphasis on birth rates is linked to nationalism, and also the war against migration, right? So the same people, Orban is one, Maloney is another, who want to reproduce the nation and want to have control over social reproduction in that way, are tend to be both racist and homophobic and transphobic. Oh, I'm sorry, not both, but all of these things are working together. There's an anti-migrant, pro-heteronormative family, anti-gay lesbian family in most cases, not Israel, because if you're reproducing the demographic advantage for Jewish people, they will give you technology. You know, I think we have to put it in that context. I'm not worried about falling birth rates. I think the earth could probably handle that.
I mean, is there a way to talk about demographic aging without falling into, as you say, these very homophobic, very transphobic, and often very nationalist and racist discourses?
Yes. Well, give me an example.
Okay, so for instance, if I'm looking at the UK and I go, oh, okay, we have an aging population, my friends.
Yes.
We have a economy which is then going to require much more taxation on the working age population to support people who are aging. Is there a way to talk about that and talk about to put it really crudely, the sort of needs of the labour market and how it relates to social reproduction without falling into something which is inherently, like a patriarchal, forcing people into these categories which might not fit with their humanity?
I think opening the door to further migration would be a great idea. Emptying your indefinite detention camps, I think that would be good. You'd have labor, more people. Seems like a great idea.
I'm with you. You in the book, you connect this war on so-called gender ideology to fascism, to climate catastrophe, and saying these are not things that you can separate off from one another. These are all working to support one another. And then when it comes to what is to be done about it, you talk about developing a counter-imaginary. And I suppose I'm wondering, what is a counter-imaginary?
Yeah. Well, that's what we're doing right now. We're developing one together.
I don't think it can defeat Viktor Orban, though.
We're just getting started.
But I mean, to talk about what we're doing now, and to be harsh on it, are we not sort of, this is a self-selecting group of people?
Yes, but we all go out in the world. We all go out in the world.
Is the sort of the ambition of political activity to sort of get self-selecting groups of people to change how they talk and think, and the hope that it will change how other people talk and think? Because the other side, they've got newspapers.
I know.
Fuck ton of money. Think tanks.
I know.
Are we bringing vibes to a gunfight?
I hear what you're saying. Well, let me take a couple of steps back and quit my vocation as a comedian, although it was always an alternative path for me. I do regret not having taken it sometimes, especially last week when the media was so rough on me. Okay. This is what I think. First of all, I just think it needs to be known that the anti-gender ideology movement, as it works throughout Eastern Europe, Latin America, parts of Africa, East Asia, certainly, Russia as well, as we know, that it is not just focused on trans. It's focused on gay and lesbian rights, gay and lesbian parenting and families. It's focused on women's reproductive rights. It's focused on gender-based violence, wanting to undermine international protections against gender-based violence, as, for instance, encoded in the Istanbul Convention. Okay, many countries have now, under the influence of the anti-gender ideology movement, withdrawn from that convention, including Turkey. So this movement is not just focused on trans. It certainly is, but it's actually sex education, books for children, activism, lesbian, gay, trans, feminist activism in Russia, elsewhere, in Hungary, very rough going. Poland's opening a little bit more now. We should ask about their mobilizations and why that's happening in the way that it is. It's really exciting. But I think we have to remember that this right-wing move, it's a movement, but it's also a trend within several right-wing movements, which is a distinction, that this is targeting all these people who are arguing with each other here. Okay, we think we're on different sides of the debate, but we're being targeted by the exact same people, and we would be very foolish to let them target us and unify us as a target better than we unify ourselves as a movement of resistance and social transformation. So this book is trying to produce a more global framework for some of these local debates so that we might remind ourselves what the stakes are. And if you look at in Latin America, for instance, in Chile or Argentina, the feminist movements are saying, we're against violence and femicide. We're also against the killing of trans people. We're against the abandonment and injury of indigenous people and the killing of indigenous people. We actually are seeing that the same powers or an interlocking set of powers are hurting a wide range of people in very similar ways, and we need to bond together, right? And that's what an expansive coalition is. So if you ask me about a counter-imaginary, I want to say, let's look at the expansive coalitions and see how they're operating, how they represent themselves, how they persuade broader publics. And neo-namenos, I mean, you know, they went into churches, they went into factories, they helped unionize the women janitors. They, you know, they went into a wide number of communities where it was not clear that they would be welcome, both to listen and to also revise their analysis on the basis of what they heard. Oh, great idea. And to make broader alliances, which is why they could have a million people on the street just, I think, 10 days ago. So I think the counter-imaginary is with us, but it has to do with being willing to be part of alliances where we don't love each other. We don't want to have dinner together. You know, we're not going to be reading the same books, maybe some of the same books. That would be good if we could have a reading list for a potential future alliance. You know, alliance is not love. Alliance can be really rough, but right now it seems to me, given how I do think that there are fascist passions being stoked, like migrants are going to come take your job, the great replacement theory. Trans people are going to come take your status as a woman away. Trans people are going to de-sex you. You're not going to be able to be a male or a female anymore. They're going to destroy your family. They're going to insert the devil into your children's curriculum rather than God's word. You know, we actually need to get smarter about how this is working, because all those people who are now afraid, oh, race, gender, ethnic studies, migrants, trans people, those fears help support increasingly authoritarian regimes that promise order, authority, a return to a time past when everything was ordered and you knew who you were and what your life was and your livelihood was secured. Now, when I say your livelihood was secured, we see a lot of people are afraid that their livelihood is no longer secured. Most young people I know don't believe their livelihood is secured. Neoliberalism has devastated so many people's ways of living and ways of working, forced them from their homes and their jobs, or made life increasingly precarious. So people are made nervous. They're made nervous by climate change, by war escalating as we speak. If you, as a right-wing political operator, if you reach into that fear and say, guess what? The reason you're so afraid, the reason you're so anxious, the reason that the future is unclear is gender or race or migration. You're able to reorganize and stoke those fears and anxieties in a direction that moves against those minorities or against those populations in favor of a really strong state.
Support independent journalism and set up a regular donation to Navarra Media from just £1 a month. Head to navarra.media/support or face the consequences.